a wood in a valley in the Marches of Wales by an abandoned railway line, there lives a 75-year-old man called Bob Rowberry. His home is an ancient school bus whose engine has died and whose wheels have fallen off. A Hero for High Times is the story of how he ended up in this broken-down bus, on this abandoned line, in this forgotten part of the world. It tells of how, along the way, Procol Harum were named after his cat, how he sold Owsley Acid to R.D. Lang, how he annoyed Saddam Hussein and the IRA, and how he was freed from jail in Mexico by a popular uprising of the peasantry who'd come to know him as El Maestro. It's also the story of his times and the ideas that shaped him. It's a story of why you know your birth sign, why you have friends called Willow, why Yoko Ono affected how we eat much more than Linda McCartney ever did, why sex, drugs and rock and roll runts mattered more than money, why dance music stopped the New Age travellers from travelling, and why you need to think twice before taking the brown acid. That is an introduction from Ian Marchant's new book, A Hero for High Times. Ian was kind enough to let me quote from his introduction there. And I'm actually going to do a podcast with Ian himself next week, if all goes to plan. So this is about Bob, though. Bob is the subject, or one of the kind of main protagonists in Ian's new book, A Hero for High Times, as you've just heard. And I first heard about Bob from some friends that we were staying with last autumn in Herefordshire. And they told me he's quite a well-known character in the area, if he's been around for a number of years. And they told me some stories about his charisma and how he was a resourceful, creative guy who lived by himself in the woods in an old school bus. And he just sounded like such a... I just got a really good feeling about him and I wanted to meet him. I thought he'd be a great subject for the podcast, really, as a man who's really lived the life of an adventurer and he's took risks and not been afraid to seek out unusual experiences. He certainly has plenty of tales and he loves to tell them. So I went over to Bob's school bus in a valley in the Welsh Borders and we sat down and recorded a chat in the bus over coffee and Bob smoking his cigarettes. And it was quite a long chat in the end, so I'm going to put this out in two parts. The first part today, the next part will come in a week or so's time. And if you enjoy the episode, you can find out more about Bob and the themes around his story through Ian's new book, which, as I mentioned, is called A Hero for High Times, published by Jonathan Cape, and I think it's being released mid-February. So do have a look for that. I'm sure you can pre-order it now if you want to. And we'll have a chat with Ian to get his side of this whole relationship and the story and behind the book. So that is this episode's guest, Bob Rowberry, in the first ever two-part episode of the Lumieres podcast. Thank you for joining me, as ever. I do hope you enjoy this episode. And I do hope you're well. It's late January here in Wales and things are not as chilly as they could be. So I'm quite happy about that. But it's still a very cozy time. So grab yourself a hot brew, take a seat by the fire, and join me and Bob for a twisting, turning conversation all about his life. Thanks again to Bob for being up for this. Thank you to Drag City Records and Six Organs of Admittance for the music. And thank you to yourselves for tuning in. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on Facebook, Life in Fractals, and Instagram, same moniker, Life in Fractals. Or drop me a mail through the contact form on the www.lumierespodcast.com website. Until the next time, be well. Could you describe for people listening where we're sitting?
Oh, we're sitting in an old school bus, a van, a Mercedes-Benz van, which was used as a school bus in the Ludlow area. A friend of mine actually went to school in it. And it's in a small wood, a 12-acre wood, on the Welsh Borders, the Radnorshire Valley. Wrong side of the hill for solar power, but that's what I've got. And, well, a hill with trees on it, you know, on the wrong side.
Yeah, it's
not great, but...
So how long have you been here, then? Like, how long have you been based in the bus on this in this woodland?
Getting on for 10 years.
For 10 years?
Yeah.
Wow. And have you been always living here on your own, or...?
Yeah, I've had... girlfriend staying, you know, day or week or two or whatever.
But
living, I like living on my own.
Yeah.
It's, right, you haven't got anyone warm to cuddle up with at night, but, you know, when you get into your 70s and that, it's not so important. And you'd have none of the stresses of living with other people.
Yeah.
Even someone you generally get on with, it's still, you know, you've got to compromise all the way through.
Exactly, yeah, and, yeah.
I like being able to do, just do what I want to do, how I want to do it, when I want to do it. Just totally selfish bastard, really. I mean, sort of.
And why not, you know, when you, you know, well, if you can. Yeah, so when did you eat 10 years ago? So
before that, I was living in vans.
Yeah.
On the road, like in lay-bys and just wherever. In fact, when Thatcher brought in the criminal justice bill, making it things tougher for travellers, I actually set up a little business. Oh, you know, not a registered business or anything, just to put an advert in local paper. Vanguard House, which, you know, sort of, you're going away on holiday, you want someone there, I don't need to use the house.
Right, okay, yeah.
You know, sort of thing, but feed pets and blah-de-blah, and if necessary, water garden, that sort of thing, and make sure no one comes in and robs you. Because, you know, my vans have always been mobile workshops as well as home.
So you're kind of foreshadowing the whole house-sitting thing that's going on at the moment?
Well, no, not foreshadowing. I mean, there was, you know, I had friends who were house-sitting and being paid to stay in other people's houses.
Really?
I mean, but not living with their own...
With their own mobile.
Taking their own home, you know, sort of there. So we just turned up at someone's house and living in it for however long.
Yeah.
And getting paid for it, which was, I thought, well, that's all
right. That's not bad.
And, So I did the Vanguard House thing for a bit, but fed up. It was great in some places. I was using the electric to do arc welding and doing jobs there. And, you know,
and why not?
Never had any problems. No, I did one, but I wasn't staying in the van. A bloke in Prestine had a lovely double axle trailer, an Ivor Williams sort of, you know, drop side trailer, really smart one.
Hmm.
And some fuckers nicked that while I was staying in the house.
Oh, no.
But if I'd been in my van, they wouldn't have nicked it, because I heard it go, but because it was across the road from a borehole drilling works, so there was a lot of that sort of equipment going in and out, and it was literally right opposite there, so I just presumed that their workers had started earlier. Because I heard the noise, the clanking of it and all that. But... Anyway, so, yeah, the van living I got into initially... by driving out overland to Central Asia, Afghanistan particularly.
When are we talking?
Late 60s. And because most of... it's all, you know, it's all like the Wild East out there. You know, like all of Central Asia is, you know, and if you've got a vehicle, if you stay in a hotel, and the hotels is a whole different... think differently about hotels, yes, you know, really, really rough sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very likely your vehicle's going to get broken into while you're sleeping in wherever it is. So it obviously makes sense to sleep in
the
vehicle.
Yeah.
And the first time I went out, there was just a VW van, not even a VW bus, just a van.
Like mattress in the back kind of thing.
Mattress in the back sort of thing, exactly, yeah. But I liked it. And then the third trip was more or less on public transport. The third trip, I had a beautiful lorry. It was a 1937 Ford. It was built as a... It was coach-built back. It had built for the civil defence as a high-speed personnel carrier. And it had a V8 petrol engine in the front, and the rear axle... ratio was such it did over 80 miles an hour, and now for a fucking 1937 lorry, that is extraordinary. And it had done 3,200 miles from new when I bought it, and it cost 70 quid. It was a bargain.
It cost 70 quid.
Yeah.
And you drove that to Afghanistan?
Yeah, and I had a great time just cruising down the autobahns of low 40 just to save fuel, you know, because it was, you know, a bit juicy being a V8 petrol engine.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know if you ever travelled in Germany with old vehicles on the road.
Not with old vehicles.
But they don't like it. They really don't like it.
Huh.
I don't think it's a nationalistic thing. It's they just don't like old vehicles on the road, and they'll give you loads of gob. just driving past you, hurling abuse at you for having an old vehicle on the road. Anyway, when I'd get this from truck drivers, and I know all their trucks are geared for the low 70s, you know, they'd go past me doing 60, 65 sort of things. And if they gave me any gob, I'd sort of get up level with them. And then they'd look a bit surprised, and they'd floor it a bit more, and they'd pull away, and I'd let them. And then they'd go, and I'd, you know, do that as many until I know they're going flat out and looking a bit surprised, and then I'd floor mine and just sort of wobble up the road away from them.
Leave them in the distance.
And then, you know, I'd slow down and to a sensible speed and let them pass. But no gob did they give me the second time.
Intimidation by overtaking. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's childish, but it was fun. Yeah. You know, what can you say?
But I mean, on those autobahns, people go crazy speeds, and it's like the respect is like, oh, if he's going really fast, then you've got to respect him, pull over, and yeah, it's another world, isn't it? But so, why did you? What was it about Central Asia that drew you over there? Because like you said, you went there a few times.
I was already drawn from reading Kipling as a kid.
Yeah.
And the stories about the Wiley Patan and all that sort of thing. And I just sort of fascinated by it. And then I read histories of the Afghan wars and became even more interested in the place. And I was living in London at the time, and a friend who I hadn't seen for a year or two, well, I was in my teens still then, he was suddenly there in a pub. "Hi, Tom, haven't seen you for a while. Where you been?" And he had a sheepskin coat on of an unusual type, embroidery on the coat.
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, I've just come back from Afghanistan, and that's where I got the coat, which I'd mentioned, for sort of £3 or something." All right. And I was into some, had access to money at the time, sort of thing. I had a very rich girlfriend, basically.
Yeah.
And so I said, "Well, let's go back out there and get a whole load of
these
Afghani coats, sheepskin coats, postincha they're called." The fact that you could buy hash out there for £3 a pound would also influence this sort of decision.
Yeah. So this is the late 60s? Or
yeah.
Where? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you set off to Afghanistan in a...
like initially a VW van.
With the aim of getting these sheepskins to come back and sell in London.
But we had some adventures on the way. Tom, our guide, because he had been there before, sort of thing, and spoke a little Turkish and a little Farsi, decided to go and visit the south coast of Turkey en route, sort of thing, which is fine, yeah? I mean, the Mediterranean coast of Turkey, yes, please.
Yeah, yeah.
So he did a few weeks of that, and then we were travelling just north of, once Turkey left the Mediterranean, sort of thing, you know, goes down south past Beirut and Israel and all. Anyway, so we were travelling just literally a mile or two north of Syria. And the reception we got in the local cafes where you stop to eat and, you know, refresh yourself was getting really dodgy, you know, really bad. In fact, it was so bad that after a few of them, it became obvious I'd better stand, you know, with a pistol showing in my belt.
Wow.
So am I to stand by the thing? Well, the other's it, and then they'd bring me food out, sort of
Jesus.
Thing. Because it was getting really, really bad.
Because you guys were noticeably foreign, well, or like?
We didn't know. We noticed that because we had travelled, you know, over quite a lot of Turkey already, and, right, not everyone loved foreigners, but, you know, they were hospitable. If you go into a place, they're glad to see you, because, you know, there's five of us.
Yeah.
Because we had three vehicles. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're, you know, glad to see you, because you're, you know, quite an added bit of income. But no, it was getting all very, very uppity. In fact, we got chased. The first place we noticed, we actually were pursued by all the guys piled out of the calf, the punters in there. Piled out of the calf. Some of them were armed with long, you know, shotguns, rifles, whatever.
Wow.
Piled into a couple of jeeps and set off after us. So I discouraged them. a bit.
Yeah.
And we had faster vehicles, fortunately, than they did. So we
But you never found out why.
Yeah, we did. But it wasn't for days and days later when we got to Tehran and got hold of a English newspaper that told us that it was a six-day war had just started down there.
Oh, bloody hell.
We only did a few miles from it, sort of thing. And I had a bad judgment in Istanbul on this trip, on the way down. We stopped in Istanbul for a bit. And we'd got friendly with a Turkish guy who was, had various talents, one of which was he could eat or appear to eat one of the fragile teacups, glasses, in fact, tulip-shaped glasses that they serve the tea in over
there.
And he could put them in his mouth and crunch them up audibly. You could hear it. And he'd bite the bits off the edge.
Of glass?
Yeah. And they do a very thin glass, yeah? And they'd do this in a tea house where he wasn't known. And basically, it was a way of getting money, an act, basically.
Ah, okay.
He had a way,
like a trick or something.
He was
actually
biting the glasses and crunching them up, no doubt about it. But in such a way, such a dexterous tongue, sort of thing, that he could do it without cutting himself.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, one of his other talents, he was a sign painter. And because we had done him some service, he said, look, I must do something for you. And what would you like? Would you like something painted on your vehicles? So Tom had Bismillah, you know, sort of God be with you sort of thing,
yeah.
and a bit of that sort of stuff on it. But I was looking through his book, and I just think, I'm afraid what appealed to me was a Habsburg double-headed imperial eagle. Black with red lining, yeah?
So okay. pretty low key then.
And the entire front of between the headlights on, you know, the front of the VW buses, entire front of that's what it was.
Wow.
Which was very similar to various Arab national flags out there. If you look at them, they're like, you've got a very similar eagle.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's what I had, which definitely looked a bit militaristic because my van was the olive green colour that a lot of Volkswagen vans
I can see how that might have been interpreted.
Anyway, and we got to Tehran and then moved on, lost the vehicle we bought out there to sell. In Munich, we'd picked up a Volkswagen variant to do a deal with in a place called Quetta in Pakistan. A nefarious deal, no doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we lost that on after Tehran on the way up to the Caspian coast. Totally wrecked, destroyed. And we had to tow it. Me driving it with only one wheel attached to the vehicle at the front. The other side was gone, completely gone. You know, the whole subframe was whipped off.
Jeez, yeah.
And it's dusty roads. It was one of the most miserable fucking drives I've ever been on. Because trying to steer a car with one wheel, it's all bottoming into the dirt and the dust from the motor in front that's towing. It's about 150 miles now.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Anyway, we did that and got to Afghanistan. We entered the country, and at the end of the customs compound, on the outside of the customs compound, there's a mud hut, small room made of mud. There's some local blokes in there, a big hubbly bubbly pipe going on there, and so we scored a bit of hash there, and they lit up the hubbly
in the customs
pipe. In the customs yard still, yeah. One of our party, Tom's girlfriend Jenny, was a lovely late teens blonde beauty. She was gorgeous, yeah, and she could smoke. And these guys looking at her with delight because, the stuff of dreams.
Yeah.
And she thought, she's going to have one toke of this and just, because that's exactly what I did. She smoked them all under the table.
No way.
They must have thought she was some goddess.
She'll be the stuff of legends.
A couple of years after that, No, it was on that same trip. Leaving the customs compound in Iran, entering Iran, I had with me a Webley 45 ex-army revolver and ammunition. And I had some rather spurious bit of paper issued by the Board of Trade saying I was allowed to take this gun out of the country, which was a fact. The British government allowed me to take this gun out of the country. That's all it meant. It didn't mean I had any right to carry it anywhere, but I think it was a device issued by the British government so their agents could have a gun.
Okay.
The small bit of paper, but the treatment on this paper was extraordinary. There was nothing you could do to paper that would make it look more impressive. It was a very fancy bit of paper.
How did you manage to keep it in that pristine condition during the trip?
What, the bit of paper?
Yeah.
Well, it was just a small bit of paper. I kept it in my passport.
Okay.
And we could see they were going to search our bags going into Iran, yeah? And I had discreetly put the gun in its holster in my suitcase or bag, whatever I had to hold all. And I thought they were going to open it, so I said, there's a gun in there, because I didn't want them to suddenly get all freaky, panicky. And they said, oh, you can't take that into Iran. No, it's all right, I've got the paper. It worked. I tried it I tried it initially in France just to see if it would work, basically, and it did.
Wow.
And it's just bullshit, baffles brains, enough lions, unicorns, crowns, and perforations, stamps, and embossing.
It just looks so official, they've got no choice.
It looks so official, yeah. And they can't, I can actually read it. anyway, they said, oh, you can't take that. And then I said, no, I've got the paper. And I didn't know what to make of it, except it had the gun's name and number on it, sort of thing. So it's obviously official, very, very, very official. And I said, well, what we'll do, we'll wire the trigger so you can't fire it. I said, okay. So I wrapped a bit of wire around it, you know what I mean by a lead custom seal?
No.
Just a block of lead with a hole in it. You put a wire through and then squeeze it with a special thing.
So it locks it, basically.
Yeah. Well, I said, okay. And when we'd finished our business, they said, all right, on your way. And I stopped between there and the gate, which is only about 100 yards, loaded the fucking gun, pulled the custom seal off and fired the fucking gun out the window. Can you imagine how stupid that could be?
Yeah, I can.
Well, that's me, mate. I'm guilty of being that fucking stupid.
How did they not come after you and chuck you in prison then after that?
Because they didn't have a car.
Okay.
In Turkey, when I was coming through with the lawyer I mentioned earlier, it wasn't actual customs, it was an army check a few miles further inland from the border, in Iran, this is. And I'd been warned about this place by Tom, I mentioned earlier. He said, they're a pain in the arse. They got nothing to do. Hardly anyone uses that road because it's a real back road.
Yeah.
And you're it. You're their entertainment for the day. So, no, they just fuck you about. You know, literally you're their amusement for the day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I could see as I was driving towards the pole across the road sort of thing, and guys with rifles standing there. So, and I made like I was slowing down, and changing down and looking, making like I was slowing down. And just when I got about from here to the back of my van, I just floored it. Now, this fucking truck had hardly any weight in it, but really leapt forward, really went.
Yeah, yeah.
And a big roaring sound you don't expect from an old lorry. And just smashed through the fucking, literally drove through the barrier, broke it. And just kept me foot down, and I don't know if they fired any shots off. I was probably too surprised, and bouncy truck on a bendy, windy road. They didn't seem to find
and
any holes
off
anywhere in it. We was gone. But I noticed they didn't have a vehicle.
Okay. Yeah. So is it fair to say you like taking the odd risk, Bob?
The evidence does point that way. And when I was a child, I was raised near Aldershot.
Yeah.
And I could get from the garden of the house I lived for most of that time onto the army land, which was vast. Scots pines on sort of sandy, hilly soil, Surrey Hills sort of thing, basically.
Yeah, I know.
And I used to bring mortar bombs home live. Mortar bombs, which was supposed to have exploded on impact, but somehow hadn't. I knew where the mortar range was, and I would slip in there, when it wasn't being used.
Yeah, yeah.
And find the bombs that hadn't gone off on impact and take them home.
Wow. Hi, Mum, I've just bought you a bomb.
Yeah, she was used to it. She didn't want them in the house.
No doubt.
No.
So, what did you do with them?
I chucked them away. Well, not much you can do with them. I tried throwing them at things and they hadn't gone off, fortunately.
Yeah, yeah. Fortunately, yeah.
I can't understand why I didn't drop them on trains from the local railway bridge, but I didn't.
Good.
Yeah, I'm glad of that.
But probably a good thing.
I'm surprised I missed out on that one.
Oh, goodness. So you spent quite a fair bit of your... Have you sort of teens and 20s travelling then? Or were you kind of on the road then after
no,
that?
No, I left home. I'd done a couple of years at straight work. I left, left, well, actually 14 when I left school, but and as soon as I was 15, which wasn't long after that, I could work legally. Which I did. I was an indentured engineering apprentice, but that came to grief.
Mm.
And I'd already discovered all-night jazz clubs in London and the middle classes, particularly middle-class girls. Middle-class girls with cars. Fucking hell, that was something. And anyway, sort of these... would take me up to London to all-night jazz club, Ken Collier's sort of all-night jazz club. And there I met people of my own age who were living rough on the streets of London. Mm. And that sort of, I found that rather appealing because I fancied living in London, but, with no money. I was earning like less than £3 a week working sort of thing. Mm. So savings were not something I had. So I threw me lot in with the kids living on the streets of London, and which was very interesting.
Yeah. So you'd consciously decided to live on the streets.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it aside from the financial sort of freedom of that? What appealed about that?
The adventure.
Yeah.
Well, it's far more adventurous living up on the streets of a city than living in some. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it's so interesting that you chose to do that, you know.
Like, yeah, well, I've always sought adventure.
Mm. Mm.
Always.
Mm.
I mean.
I think that's a great way to, this, how what we think of as adventure these days is not the same thing, I don't think, as maybe what it was for you.
Adventure nowadays seems to be, organised adventure.
Yeah.
We will provide you with a bungee thing and you will give us money and jump off a bridge.
Get your adrenaline rush and then...
Yeah, or you will...
That's it.
Jump out of a aeroplane and we will hold on to you and... it's corporate
commodified.
Adventure. Yeah, commodified. Yeah. That's a much better word. Sorry, I was going to say something that might be sort of remotely interesting, but I've totally forgotten what it was then.
So how did you, after you were living on the streets, how did you adapt to that? Like, did you just find it quite easy? Or was it, I mean, it's a hard life, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it was interesting, fun.
And this is when, the 50s, 60s?
Late 50s, yeah. The end couple of years of the 50s. Yeah.
And what was London like at that time?
Still a hell of a lot of war damage.
Yeah.
A lot big, which made living on the streets easier, because there was many half houses, half of it just not there and just a hole, but, there were one or two rooms.
Ah, right.
You
wow.
could, slip into, and if there was a chimney attached, where there usually was, it was, if any wall was up, it was a wall with a chimney in it. you know, and you'd burn whatever's left of the floorboards in the chimney. But look, around the Covent Garden, like West End area, there was loads of them. And, which made things easier. Sometimes I'd sleep on park benches with, you know, genuine down and out types, older, you know, old people.
Did you find them welcoming to you, or did you find it like...
Not at all threatening. Yeah. I saw one thing that really shocked me, though. Well, that amused me. It was the Charing Cross Cross embankment, the embankment by where Charing Cross and the Hungerford Bridge, at the northern end of Hungerford Bridge. So every bench was occupied by, you know, homeless people. And I noticed a woman, a homeless, you know, woman, going around, and basically she was giving the guys blowjobs for some coin or bottle, changed hands. And I was really touched by that, actually. Even in this worst, you know, sort of, there's still things, you know, other stuff going on.
Yeah. Wow. It's a crazy environment. So how long were you living on the streets in London then?
Probably less than a year, really.
Yeah.
Because I got to know people, got to be known on the scene, a sort of face on the scene sort of thing. And because it was like the music scene that a lot of it was sort of centred around. So that was the scene I got me face, and subsequently I got to meet quite a lot of people who went on to become, you know, sort of big bands of the 60s.
Oh yeah.
You know, the top, you know, top people. I've actually held the hat. This is absolutely God's truth. I've held the hat for Eric Clapton, who was playing under the fucking arches on between Charing Cross mainline station and the Thames, the little street, Villiers Street.
Yeah.
Goes down next to Charing Cross and there's some arches down there, and there was a coffee bar just 150 yards away from there called the Gyre and Gimble, affectionately known as the G's, which was open all night sort of thing. And if you played, you know, an instrument, you'd be welcome. Clapton was playing the banjo when I first met him.
The banjo?
Yeah. And it was a bloke who later became a really close friend, Long John Baldwin. He probably means nothing to you, but he was... Well, one time Long John had Rod Stewart and Elton John as his backing singers in his band. Yeah, so, seriously. Anyway, I have a good picture in my mind of Long John teaching Clapton, who incidentally nicked the first girl I ever fucked while I was up to Liverpool. He took her.
You're never forgiven him for that.
I'd moved on to other things anyway.
It's such a interesting to hear you talk about that, like people who we now know as such like famous faces, like those sort of days when they were just
playing,
getting along and playing the banjo. Yeah. Wow, crazy. Yeah, so you must have seen quite a few.
In fact, the last time I saw that guy in the flesh, I'd gone through some changes, and during that time Eric Clapton had become a big star. But the relevant part is I didn't know Eric was Eric Clapton. I never knew a surname. He didn't go for surnames.
He's just
Eric.
Yeah.
So anyway, so the next time I see him, I'm just pulling up in my XK120 Jag.
Hang on. You're pulling up in your XK120 Jag?
Yeah, you're from... one of the most beautiful sports cars ever made, yeah.
But where? How did you...
Well, this is in the car park of the Scotch St. James, so then... a great nightclub where they had music. Right. And I'm, you know, dressed pretty well, and I just coming out of the Scotches, Eric Clapton with one of the girl on his arm. I later learnt to be one of the Ormsby Gore girls, you know, Alice Ormsby Gore, I later knew her. Anyway, that's Eric. And we're looking, you know, last time we saw, we were in sort of donkey jackets, dirty jeans, they were all groomed and, you know, sort of going into, you know, well, club most people couldn't get into.
Right, a bit exclusive.
Sort of thing. It wasn't a money thing. It was
who you know. And...
Yeah, who you are, who you know. Anyway, sort of thing. I got to the door and the... I said to Eric, "Hi, Eric. It's nice to see you. Looking good. Still playing the banjo then?" And he'd been saying similar things to me until that moment. And he must have thought I was taking the mickey out of him or something.
Because he's like, right, they associate
me
with the banjo.
Well, you fucking Eric Clapton, you know. Jesus Christ.
It's going to kill my reputation.
He's number one or whatever, you know. He was a big star, at that time.
When's this then? Is this in still in the 60s? Or like,
oh, Christ, yeah.
Was he in Cream at that point?
I was 21, I'd say, so that would be about 63.
Yeah.
So whatever band he was in then, a lot of singers must have been Cream, yeah.
Well, yeah, he would have been super famous. So he didn't like that.
He really didn't like that and stormed off. I was a bit perplexed, but I went, fine. Got to the door where and the manager of the club was outside, who was a mate I had had adventures with, this guy. I said, I didn't know you knew Eric Clapton then. I said, oh, dear me, nor did I. I mean, but the Scotch, St. James Christ, what a place. You'd get Jimi Hendrix was often there, and there was a small stage, you know, only about that high off the ground, with very small, not much bigger than, you know, the area of the band there, with a drum kit, several guitars and amps there, and whoever wanted to play would. And you can imagine, I mean, Hendrix was often up there playing. Keith Moon was often drumming for him and stuff like that.
That's off.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Amazing time to have witnessed that, eh?
Yeah.
Like, they don't make them like
I'm
that
I'm so
anymore,
glad I was around then and just my past went the way it did.
Yeah.
Because it was, I don't know, extraordinary. I mean, and I could just breathe in there, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there'd be a queue of people who couldn't get in. And,
Yeah, let's talk about how you ended up here, because that's, you know, this is an unusual, for most people, it's an unusual living situation, and it's fascinating how you've developed it, you know.
At the time, I was living with a girl who's still a good friend called Monica. We had gone to Afghanistan together in that lorry aforementioned.
Yeah.
And specifically to do a range of clothes. Monica was a clothes designer. And I had seen the materials and how little people worked out there and wanted to spend more time out there and have it earning its, you know, actually making a profit from the trip rather than it costing.
Yeah.
And she was up for it. She had just been a couple of things that happened in her life, boom, boom, which... I'd given her a little assistance in something that meant she had a 500 quid more than she would have had. I did, no. Sort of thing, you know, anyway. And she was happy to abandon the life she had been living because she was fucked off with it and she had been robbed.
Right, okay.
Well,
so it gave her a bit of freedom.
Yeah. So I said, well, look, I know a place where you can buy most beautiful materials for next to nothing and people... will work for what we consider next to nothing, putting the materials together, and she could cut, you see. She could cut. And, anyway, we had had a... spent over a year out there, and it was very successful. The range of clothes we did had a four-page feature in Vogue.
So where was this? Where was this?
Where was it?
In which country?
Afghanistan.
This was also in Afghanistan?
Yeah, yeah. So it was
did a four-page feature in Vogue.
Yeah, yeah, it was very successful.
Yeah.
And but when we'd come back to England, London, where we'd both previously lived, like Monica was a London girl, she was a Londoner, and we decided we didn't want London anymore because we weren't living in Kabul. Most of the time we were living out of Kabul at a place called Pagman, about 20-25 miles out of Kabul, in houses that had been built by Russians fleeing the revolution, who had obviously been wedding the southeast of the country sort of thing, and had legged it down to Kabul and built themselves a sort of enclave up in above this village, Pagman.
Yeah.
And because the houses had been built by unbelievers and not in the style of the locals,
some of whom owned these houses by then, didn't want to live in them. So when sort of hippies started turning up and say, how much do you want for this house? five a month seemed to be the going rate.
Five a month?
Yeah. And that's a big house, big garden, and generally a servant phone in. Well, not a servant, a gardener phone in, yeah. So, that's what we were doing. We were living up there.
Wow.
Anyway, by the time we got back to London, the social, the music-y, fashion-y sort of world which we were living in, or had been, had changed it, and it was heroin that had brought about the change.
So were you in the 70s here then, or later?
We're in about 70, 71, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what we'd left was hash-smoking, happy hippie, peace and love sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we got back and everyone was smackheads.
Wow.
Which, you know, I'm not snotty about that. If you opened a bag of smack on the counter and put it there, I'd gladly have a snort. But, you know, it'd be the first one this year sort of thing. So it's...
oh, careful.
So I'm not sort of...
advocating anything, yeah.
Irrationally snotty about it.
Right.
But as something that your companions are doing...
But it's a completely different thing, right? A different drug completely.
It had changed us all. It had queered it. You know, it had just made it, no, not something I want to be around.
Yeah.
And bearing in mind, because I was a country boy anyway, you know, so, I said to Monica, well, how about you and a girl, Dutch girl, a painter, Titi? Why don't you take the car and... find us somewhere to live in the country, you know, the wilder the better sort of thing. A few days later they came back and said, yeah, we found a place on the Welsh borders. I'd never been to Wales.
Really?
At that point, yeah.
Wow. You'd been to Afghanistan but you'd never been to Wales?
Never been to Wales. I'd seen Wales when I was a Boy Scout. You could see it from the place we camped on in Gloucester. You could see Wales, but that was the nearest I'd been to it. Yeah, yeah, it's funny that.
Isn't it?
Well, I've never been to Ireland even now, and I've got friends in Ireland who say, look, I've got a place right on the beautiful south west peninsula there, you know, owning, you know, a good few acres of lovely hill.
Mm.
Please come and build yourself a home here sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I haven't been on a visit. Anyway.
Yeah. So she found the place up here. Was it, yeah. I mean, Where did she initially find? Like, was that
about
around
6 miles north of Hay-on-Wye, a place called Bryngwyn?
Okay,
which is just a church and a couple of houses, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Above, well, you don't know this area, so there's no
bits
point.
Bits and bobs.
Payne's Castle.
Yeah, stuff. I know where Payne's Castle is.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, if you come in towards Kington from Payne's Castle, the next place you come to is Roscoe.
Uh huh.
Well, if you go up the hill, you know, from Roscoe, you'll that'll be Bryngwyn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it's a two up, two down farmhouse with it had electric but no water. It had a spring about 100, you know, not even 100 yards, 50 yards uphill from it, which I pretty well promptly got a bit of hose and stuck in the fucking spring. And
so you guys bought it together, did you?
No, we didn't buy it.
You
no,
didn't
we
buy
just
it?
Fucking rented it.
You just rented it?
Again, it was five a week, I think.
Yeah.
In them days.
Wow.
And that was with a garden and barns, several barns we could use, which was good because I was doing motorbikes at the time. One of the things I was doing, I had loads of motorbikes.
And how did you find the transition of going from like that sort of, I mean, it's quite...
No problem at all. I thought, well, I didn't know how to deal with Welsh farmers, but the particular Welsh farmer I had to deal with was old school type,
yes.
Real old school. Lots of baler twine amongst his clothing sort of thing. And I thought, oh, I'd just treat him the same as I would an Afghan.
Yeah.
Which only got on fine with the Afghans. You know,
yeah,
really did get on well with them.
Yeah.
And it worked. I'll tell you a funny story about like getting on with the Afghans. We was in this house I mentioned earlier, and not the Welsh one, the one up in Pagman.
Where you were doing the clothing
up
stuff.
Up in the hills.
Yeah.
It was at night. We were in bed, not asleep, and I heard this noise. It was coming from one of the other rooms. And they don't have putty out there. And I sort of had an idea what the noise was. It sounded to me like someone was wrinkling the little tacks that is all that holds the windows in. Yeah. No putty, no beading, just loads of little tacks. And it sounded like someone pulling these little tacks out with a pair of pliers. So I didn't, we didn't have any lights to turn on. If we need lights, we'd have to start the generator, which I think is what they'd be after.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the door was ajar anyway, looking into the room, and there's big windows around, two sides. It was a corner room. And there was a couple of local guys out there doing what I thought they were doing. And it was a bit of an embarrassing situation because I had a shotgun in my hand, sort of thing, loaded. And I thought, right, I could sneak, creep out around the house and face-to-face surprise them.
Yeah.
I thought, I really don't want to do that because one of them might have a fucking shoot and just whip it out and put one through me. And it would also be embarrassing, yeah? Because if I see them in the bazaar next day, in the village, and I'd... So I did not want a confrontational situation.
Okay. But something had to happen.
I wanted something had to happen, yeah. And because I'm a bit of a fucking idiot, I thought, right, here's what I'll do. I turned the shotgun at the window beside them, which is quite a big window, sort of a metre by a metre square sort of thing.
Yeah.
And blew that out. Now, I had never fired a shotgun in a darkened room before. Fucking hell. The flash lights up the room bright yellow. The window, because not only is the force of the shot hitting it, but the actual blast, explosion has hit that window.
And come back.
And woof, that window just went out in one or just million pieces.
Wow.
And these guys, they just ran, obviously just fucking ran. They were going to stand there and say, hey, what's happening here, man? Anyway, they legged it, and in the morning I went out and I found their both pairs of sandals, because they're all, like everyone, all the locals wear sandals.
Yeah, yeah.
They're really heavy-duty, car tire sole sandals. Really, these are not lightweight beach wear. They're,
meant for every day.
Everyday mountainous. So, and I've got to go down to Kabul to get a pane of glass. So I'm going down in my truck, and I stop in the middle of the village where there's sort of a bit of a squarey sort of thing with a couple of trees on it. I bring out two pairs of sandals and put them very respectfully in a nice place under the trees sort of thing. But everyone, because all the merchants are all clocking me, what's he doing? Because they'll have heard the story by then. And so I drove off and they see what I'd done, and I got on all right with them before that, but I was that totally in like Flynn, and because it was funny, they'd got two laughs out of it, so.
That endeared you. So how did that train you for dealing with Welsh farmers then? Were you armed with the shotgun then?
No. I just treated them as foreign people who speak a different language, and I want to get on with them because I'm planning to live where they live.
Yeah, exactly.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Be curt, and if you can find a way to slip a couple of quid in their direction, or right from the offset sort of thing, mm-hmm. You've got some nice cabbage there, you sell one, So that's how I treat them. Well, it's that same as I would anyone else, really.
Yeah.
But without going for all the English pretentious bullshit stuff, stuff you often have to subject yourself to. We found out.